just in the nick of time.
Oh, yeah. We're on time every time.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Little free chaos.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And you can find everything about us, as soon as I fix this little microphone dealy, you can find everything about us at wethepeopleradio.us. We've got archives dating back till 2010 on all sorts of different topics. Our first hour today is school choice for military families. And our second hour is going to be the politics of white genocide in South Africa. We've been doing a little series on South Africa the last couple of weeks. So if you feel like you get into the game late, it's okay. We've got links to 3 hours of previous programming that you can
catch up.
But we're going to do the politics side today for those of you who've been following that. And our sponsor this hour.
Sponsor this hour.
Hit it, Bill.
Is Team Power. Team Power is our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. You can find them at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they're just south of Phil's Prop Shop. They've got everything you could imagine in the way of tractors and riding lawn equipment in stock and ready to go. Their phone number is 226-9226. Give them a call or catch them on the web at readingtractors.com.
Ta-da! Yeah. All right. So let's get to our guest. We have him on the line. Peter Murphy is the vice president of the Invest in Education Foundation, and he's held this position since its founding in 2012. The Invest in Education Coalition promotes school choice and improving K-12 education. But today we're talking about how this affects military families, and there's an excellent article that he had in Town Hall I've linked for you on the web, and I'm not even going to talk about it because he wrote it, so we'll let him do all the talking. Good afternoon, Peter. How's it going?
Aaron, how are you? Nice to be on. Thank you.
Yeah, I was like, well, when you're, I don't know, I guess he's your publicist or your promoter guy, Stephen Manfredi, when he got a hold of us, I was like, wait a minute, we've talked to him before.
And I guess it was tractors, too.
Yeah, and I guess it was just in April. I'm like, no wonder he sounded so familiar.
Time flies.
I know. It seems like it was a little bit longer ago.
Yeah.
So, I guess people don't really give much thought to this, but I know that with our military families moving all over the place, you know, within the country, outside the country, education, you know, when they if they have small children, is a huge issue.
That's really it. It's something that is very disruptive, and it's, you know, it's a consideration in terms of trying to retain personnel. If you have a older teenager, younger, 20-something, who joins, like my own son, for instance, you know, they can go anywhere, they're ready to conquer the world, they've got all kinds of flexibility, but they get to their late 20s, early 30s, they're starting a family. Well, now all of a sudden, there's a lot more to think about than just yourself, and you know, what about their needs? What about their disruption? How does it affect their lives? And so, if we're going to keep experienced personnel, if we're going to keep people who have years of training under their belt, who have years of experience, then we've got to do something about the needs of their families. And what we've tried to do here in this particular area is offer them an educational option to draw down some money from a savings account that the Department of Education would establish in their name if they want it. And they could access funds to go to any school they want, any private school they could pay tuition with. They could homeschool if they want. Many military families, twice the rate of military families homeschool their kids compared to civilians. They could do online learning now. They could even buy specialty courses from a public school district. But the upshot being that it's just another inducement to say, well, here's something that can help with the education of your children, particularly as you move. You may want to have a consistency about your education in a private setting or whatever, homeschooling. So it's the type of thing that is long overdue, and it's just a way to address a niche need. I mean, not every military family is going to access this. It's their option. But we need to have it out there because it's sending another message that we've invested in you and we want you to stay in. and continue to defend our country.
And how much of the military budget currently is spent on this type of programs for the vets and their families? Any of it?
Well, the military budget is north of $600 billion. This is a real drop in the bucket. There is educational expenses that go into it. It's a very small number. There's about 15 or so Defense Department-operated schools that are on large military bases. There used to be a lot more, but as the country has built up over time and communities have built up around bases, and, you know, we've got 320 million people as opposed to, you know, 125 million.
Mm-hmm.
So you have communities that have built up and school districts that have formed, but there's a lot fewer of the Defense Department-operated schools, which are very expensive.
Sure.
So most military families live in a community, live in a school district, but they move around a lot, and they may end up in a district, and many do, end up in a district that doesn't meet their kids' needs, that's not suitable. And so they want something better, and this gives them a chance to access something more suitable and more higher quality.
Yeah, I would imagine that keeping up with the other students when you move around a lot in the military is a little bit more of a challenge for the military kids, isn't it?
No question about it. And, you know, there are other ways to mitigate that factor. I mean, you know, fewer deployments, fewer reassignments is one approach that's been implemented to some extent. But, you know, this is just a way. It's a very modest approach. It's, you know, maybe it's $40 million in a year. You have about the bill that's floating through that Congress right now offers up to $4,500 that a military family can access per child, and we want to get that bill passed. It's H.R. 5199. It's got over 70 co-sponsors right now.
Oh, good.
But it's tough slogging because there is pushback on this from a couple of areas, but it's really something that has to be addressed one way or the other, whether it's this particular bill, whether it's another means of doing it. But if we can get education savings accounts in the hands of military families, it's a way to address a need that they've identified. But the education of their children is important to them, and it's determinative for, you know, many of them, whether they're going to stay in the military or move on to civilian growing economy.
Right.
I was going to say, when you start looking at, you know, maybe when your kids are in elementary school, you could do some homeschooling, but when you get into junior high and high school, it's a, you know, that's a heavy lift lot of folks.
And what is the I mean, it sounds like a great program. I don't know why anybody would be against it, but what is some of the pushback you're getting from this?
Well, you start with the teacher unions.
Should have seen that one coming.
You know, I mean, it's just, they're so robotic about this. They're just, anything that smacks of choice, anything that empowers families to do something other than a public school district where they live is anathema. It's
right.
Unacceptable. And it's really too bad because, I mean, this is not the end of public education as we know it. This is not, you know, going to lead to the closure of neighborhood public schools. All the embellished rhetoric that we hear from them is just would never pan out. We're always going to have public education. We always should have public ed. And the existence of a program like this is going to affect the margins. I mean, not every military family is going to access it. They don't need to.
Right.
Most military families are going to continue with the public education of their child, and that's fine. That's their choice. That's what they want to do. But quite a few of them will. And, you know, why should anyone care except that their fear is, the teacher union's fear is not that somehow the children won't get a great education. Their fear is that they will, that they will get a better education. Their fear is that this is going to work. This is going to be effective. And then it's going to catch on. It's going to metastasize.
It's going to set some horrible precedent.
Yeah,
that's what their fear is. It's still not going to end public ed. It's not going to throw any teacher out of work or anything like that. But the unions are about expansion. More dues, more members, more control, more power.
Mm-hmm. Just, more money.
It's no different than, you know, our kindergarten days in the sandbox. I mean, it's a power game of fish that they play. And, you know, every school choice battle we've had in every state in the union comes back to that. So they are opposed to any kind of experiment, any kind of pilot program. And so we just got to fight this battle and hope that the merits pan out. And again, the irony, I can't stress enough, it's not that they're afraid it's going to be somehow detrimental to children. Their fear is it's going to work for children. The families are going to be happy with it. And that's what we've seen all over the country in the 40-plus states that have some kind of school choice program. It's been effective, it's grown, and that's what they're afraid of.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to foster any programs that work. That would be completely screwed up. We have to take a quick break, Peter, and we'll come back. We've exceeded our little time limit here. Our first little segment's pretty short. We're going to be back with our guest, Peter Murphy. He is the Vice President for Policy at the Invest in Education Foundation, and you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Peter, the $64,000 question. What can they do with the money? If they passed the bill and they allowed the military families to access
it, what can they do with it?
Could they use it to, say, could their kid go, I'm assuming private school, but couldn't their child also attend a public school maybe farther away, maybe has to take some sort of transportation or something like that?
Exactly. So a child could go to a non-resident public school district in another district where they could pay tuition there. Public schools charge tuition for non-residents. So that's absolutely something they could do with that. And it's usually in that range of what's offered in the education savings account. So you have that alternative. So it's not just private schools. It's another public school and maybe in a more quality district that would have higher housing values, higher home prices, and that sort of thing that maybe they can't afford on a military salary, but at least with the education savings account, they can at least get the benefits of residency by attending that school.
I don't really know how it works when you have kids on a military base. If they're on a military base, is their school always school there?
There's only about 15 operated Defense Department schools, so not every base has schools for military families.
So they could be living on a base in base housing, but be sending their kids to whatever the local neighborhood school.
Correct.
Gosh, that's got to play havoc with the classes and the. I mean, just thinking about it from the teacher standpoint, you know, you have an influx of kids, and then poof, they're gone.
Oh, I would imagine
too. One of the things that exists now is there is a funding stream for district schools called Impact Aid, and it's designed to offset the fact that, say, a military base in the community doesn't pay property tax.
Mm-hmm.
So in lieu of property taxes, you have something called impact aid that finances the cost of, in effect, it's those military families at DOD property that's paying money to that school district.
So if the school districts
are compensated for having a large military presence right now.
Okay.
That's already covered. Now, they always say it's not enough, right? We should have more impact aid. I mean, more is not enough ever in public education, but...
Or anything else for that matter.
There is a recognition of that problem.
Would that aid be reduced if students, say, from that base elected to go to a different school district, would the local school district get penalized for those kids not attending their district?
Well, I wouldn't use the word penalized, because if they're not educating the child anymore, why should they get paid for doing
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah, that's my point. That's my, well, but that's exactly how they're going to play it.
You're cutting into
the free
money.
But their view is, we want to keep getting the money regardless of whether the child leaves or not. So, that's really what the argument's about. So you have kind of two kinds of opposition. You have the school districts that say, gee, you know, we don't touch our money. And, you know, look, my feeling is this is not a hill to die on. So find some other way to finance it. I mean, our organization's view is just, you know, get it from some other funding source. I mean, you know, you have funding sources in desk drawers in the Pentagon. I mean, it's such a vast, massive place. But then you have the other kind of opposition we talked about previously, and that's the teacher unions don't want any kind of school choice, any kind of empowerment of families that, you know, when you're not rich and you can't afford an educational alternative, they don't want those families empowered. I mean, it's so ironic, because it's the ultimate progressive policy, right? You're empowering lower income, middle class families to get better education the way wealthy people do. I mean, what's more progressive than that? And yet they're just adamantly opposed, and it's the reason it hasn't passed yet ultimately.
Yep. It's kind of like the Veterans Choice funding, so that, you know, veterans can get care outside the VA. Huge opposition.
Do we want better health care, or do we want bureaucrats to feel safe?
But the biggest opposition here?
It's just amazing this stuff goes on.
It blows my mind, but the biggest opposition is VFW, American Legion. All of the veterans groups are the ones who oppose it adamantly. And it's like, wait a second, guys, who are you advocating for?
And full disclosure, there are some veteran groups that do oppose this. And it's just this unholy alliance. And it's almost like the organizations, the interest groups themselves that purport to represent military families are more representing themselves and have their alliances with the education establishment. And, like, who are their clients? Who are they actually, whose interests are they serving here? I mean, it's a real serious question. I'm not trying to be rhetorical about it.
Well, no, but it also gets back to the same thing, even outside the military issue. If the teachers don't want kids picking a different district, then make it attractive and do a good job and make their school the principal go-to school for parents, and they wouldn't have to worry about it.
Well, theoretically, that's exactly how they should be thinking, just the way companies do, the way businesses
exactly.
do.
Exactly. Provide a better service.
But that is not the culture of public ed. I mean, and by the way, I'm not trying to paint a broad brush here. I'm not saying every educational setting or school or public setting, you know, responds that way. But the problem ultimately comes down to public education policy, which is what I'm involved in. I'm not a teacher. I've never worked in a classroom. I visited on Parents' Day and all that. That's about it. But public education policy is about the adults. It's what serves the adults' interest, not the children, which is why things like, you know, teacher evaluations, that was something that the Obama administration made a big attempt to implement around the country. I mean, it fell flat. Teachers rebelled, and they got the parents stirred up. And, you know, so the idea of evaluating teachers has really fallen away. The accountability factor is really diminished. So, you know, it's this ongoing story. It's what the adults want. It's not always what's the best interest of the children. That's what we're up against.
And military families, what kind of advocacy do they have on their own behalf?
Well, there's a number of organizations that are pushing for this, including military organizations, you know, that represent. So we have some, and the opposition has others, and right now it's at a standstill. And I think the real rub right now in Congress is the use of impact aid. I mean, we try to approach this. Congressman Banks and his bill for 5199, he's from Indiana. He's a military man himself. He tried to keep this revenue neutral, simply use an existing funding stream and allow parents to access that money. And that ended up you know, rubbing up against too many interests, and other congressmen got, you know, sort of became bedwetters about it and didn't want to go there. And, oh, some of my district people aren't going to be happy. And so a number of, not just Democrats, but Republicans as well, just said, no, I don't want to stir that pot back home. I mean, I'm with you. I'm for school choice, love military families, but let's not do it this way. So my feeling is, okay, let's do it another way. I mean, you spend more money every year, whether the bureaucracy needs it or not. You spend more money than what the administration asked for. Take some of that added spending and use it for this. I mean, I don't see what's so complicated here, but we're also folks competing against just the barrage of issues that we're trying to get done as the year draws nigh. I mean, I realize it's only June, but you know, you've got summer, August break, and then you've got
everything just takes a long time back
September,
there.
And yeah, so we're really competing against a lot of open issues right now.
But see, like if you actually look at the bill, and maybe for people who haven't read a lot of bills, this is actually a good one to cut your teeth on because it's pretty basic. But when you look at the list of the use of funds in the bill, mm-hmm. And I did link that on the page if people want to refresh and click on that. But cost of attendance at a private school or secondary school organized by the state, so public school, private online learning programs. These are things the money can be used for. Private tutoring. Mm-hmm. Now, how helpful would that be?
Special ed needs.
Yep. Let's see. Textbooks, curriculum programs, computer hardware, educational software and applications, uniforms that they might need for a private school, or some public schools have uniforms now. Fees for nationally standardized assessment exams, advanced placement tests. Now, as your kids get into high school, that becomes super important. Fees for summer education programs, educational services for therapies, including occupational, behavioral, physical, speech, language. All this stuff. This would all be useful, especially if your kids are bouncing from place to place to place. You run the risk that maybe one school was a little farther ahead, maybe one was a little farther behind. You know, tutoring, I could see, they should put that one like in bold print, because if your kids move around a lot, I could see tutoring being a big deal. We need to take another really quick break. Sorry about that. And we'll be right back with our guest, Peter Murphy. And you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. For you and me, but not for military families with children who want to send their kids up to some different school.
No, there's rules for that.
that's different. The text of this bill, Peter, this is really this is not flamethrower stuff.
It's very commonsensical. It addresses one of many areas of need in military families. It should not be overlooked. And, you know, when you have a booming economy like we're experiencing now, first time in anywhere from at least a dozen years, you have a lot of these 10 and 12 year veterans that can do just fine in the civilian labor force. I mean, they can go fly planes for the private sector. They can
make a lot more money.
They can operate technology and do any number of things in the private sector. We need to retain a quality, experienced personnel, which means we better pay attention to the needs of their families. And this is one way we do it. And again, if impact aid rubs too many people the wrong way and Congress doesn't want to touch that, fine, let's fund it some other way. There's lots of pots of money sitting around in the Pentagon and the Department of Education.
Sure.
Well, this has a real tangible need. It's going to make real impact. It's going to change. But again, that's prompted another part of the opposition that because it's going to impact so positively and it could really take off, that's their fear that, you know, we can't do that. So,
well, yeah, anything that's has the hint of reducing
some government-controlled thing.
The numbers of students
like
in their classrooms or the reduction of aid, they're not even going to look at it. They're not even going to listen to it.
Well, and
it's not about the kids.
I'm always, in the back of my mind, I'm always hearing the opposition. I have like a weird, evil voice that constantly hears chatter from the opposition back there. And so here you have, this will pay for fees for state-recognized industry certification programs, tuition for preparatory courses such as exams. It'll pay for college savings accounts. So, okay, the evil voice says, oh, yeah, they just want the money. What if they don't use it for that? Oh, wait, there's a termination clause, termination and return of funds. It terminates on the date in which the student enrolls in a public elementary school or secondary school on a full-time basis. So if they get transferred to another base and the kids are lined up with the local school and they wind up going to that, this turns off.
Which, that should.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, but it isn't just free money, I guess. I mean,
no.
We should make that super clear.
Yeah, it's not welfare.
Yeah, they're not just...
it's making it available to military families. If they choose not to access it, they don't need to. And most of them, frankly, will not access it. But quite a number of them will. We're not quite sure how many will. There's really no way to predict that. But the fact that some will is enough for, you know, the establishment to have a conniption and fight back and oppose it. And so that's carried the day so far in Congress. But, you know, we're halfway through the year. There's lots of legislation still to approve. And if we can change some of the ingredients in this bill, maybe not use impact aid, maybe use some other source, maybe it'll get a new a second look.
Yeah, this is really basic legislation with some. I mean, it's not broad and vague. You know, here's their money. Parents get to figure it all out. This is really specified on. This has good. I mean, good controls on where the money's going to go, who's doing it, when it lapses, what happens if there's still money in the education savings account when the kid exits school or starts public school. It all goes back. As a taxpayer, I guess, you know, reading it as a taxpayer, I'm thinking, okay, do it. This isn't something a taxpayer would object to.
Well, not only that, but every taxpayer is invested in military personnel. If they leave early... If they leave after a few years, all the money we've invested in that person, they're not defending our country anymore. You know, there's a lot of fixed costs, there's a lot of training expenses, traveling expenses, and if they're not taking that and using that to, you know, defend the country and to continue to serve, well then that's dead weight cost. That's done. That person's vanished because they want a more stable, more predictable life for their family. So we've got to compete with that.
Right.
And this is one of many ways to compete with that, to make it worthwhile for them to continue to serve our country. And that's, look, I mean, this is about children, but it's also about military readiness, experience, and retention.
Well, that's the thing.
That's what we've got to be focused on.
Yeah,
sure.
If you want to retain good people, then, you know, you're going to have some concessions to make it easier for them to have a life.
Well, you think about it. When do most people go into the military? I mean, okay,
yeah.
This isn't everyone, but you figure about 18. If
mm-hmm.
they
right.
if they're there for 4 years, in that time period, they may have gotten married, have kids, but their kids aren't going to be school age until they've been in the military for a while. In many, many cases, well, that's the time when you're going, should we stay or should we go?
And we're trying to use this as an inducement.
Like, oh, stay. Stay. Your kids will benefit. This will be good for you. You'll get to travel and your kids' education won't suffer. And look at all the advantages.
I mean, if we had 8% unemployment, maybe the urgency would not quite be there for something like this.
Right.
Because that factor alone makes it difficult to make a billion life. But we have under 4% unemployment. There's lots of jobs out there for experienced personnel who've been trained in any number of fields. I don't mean just flying jets or shooting artillery. I mean there's
loading bombs.
The military does every range of
look at all the technical
workforce skill sets that can translate to the private sector. So,
well, just the fact that you come out of the military with some work ethic and trust me, in private sector, that alone is hard to find today.
That would be a marketable skill. Yeah, this makes a lot of sense. I don't understand how this hasn't been done in the past. I mean, do people, because you don't get to, well, I guess maybe if you're going to re-up and depending on, your MOS, depending on where you go, I guess you could sort of decide where your kids are going to grow up. But a lot of times you just get sent.
Yeah, you don't get a choice.
Right. Exactly, in terms of assignment.
Right, right.
Where you're deployed and where you're just reassigned domestically.
Interesting. And so it looks like this was introduced March of this year.
Right.
So has this bill or some version of this bill, concept maybe, has that been tried before at some point?
Well, the thing of it is, so school choice has mostly been the purview of states. So 50 states have, well, not quite 50. I mean, 40-something states have some school choice options. It's true, charter schools, education savings accounts, which this is modeled after, scholarship tax credit programs. Some cities have voucher programs. So it's traditionally been what the state legislatures and governors have done as part of their education policy. Because the military is uniquely a congressional, federal responsibility, it's put it in the lap of Congress. And Congress hasn't had a long track record of dabbling in school choice. There's some traditional view that, hey, this is a state thing and education policy is a state, yada, yada, yada. But there are things that federal government and Congress can do, particularly as it relates to overcoming opposition in states to school choice. So my home state of New York, for example, has a robust charter school program, but New York's not going to touch a education savings account policy. They're not going to touch, a scholarship tax credit that would give a K-12 scholarship funds, charitable incentives to expand and reach more families and provide better education for low-income families. That many states have resisted that kind of thing because teacher unions have an even stronger grip on state legislators, more so than they do members of Congress. So we're looking at Congress to say, hey, if this is a civil rights issue of the 21st century, if you've got persistent, 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, you've still got, horrendous educational conditions, and particularly in urban areas, but not exclusively there, if you've still got children being robbed of a better education, well, then this, there are ways you can step in without, expanding government, without violating, the separation of powers or federalism or anything like that. Congress has a role to play. Military is an obvious way, but there's even other ways Congress can do things by, again, scholarship tax credits, using the tax code to generate charitable money to go into scholarship funds. It's, 18 states have done that. Some have done that extremely well. But there's large, large, vast areas of the country that have resisted that. California, New York, other large states.
All the states that are being super well-run.
you're right. They're not going to touch school choice. And again, if you're wealthy and you live in a nice suburban district or you live in an urban area that, you can send your kids to a private school, more power to you. But for lower middle income or working class folks, you don't have a chance. And so Congress needs to take a look at this because we have generations of children that are getting a poor education, that are ending up in prison, that are ending up in a very low quality of life. And it comes back to educating them better and addressing those needs before they become crisis.
Yeah, and let's face it, folks join the military to serve their country, but that doesn't exactly put them on the upper pay scale during that time. So why shouldn't we give them a little bit of help for serving the country? I mean, I think it's pretty simple.
Well, and this, look, I mean, if you're going to give a pay raise to military, and that happens
rarely.
That doesn't happen seldom. I mean, that's a fairly recurring thing. But, you know, that is a very expensive thing. I mean, when you're giving raises to every single person wearing uniform, that does cost money, and I'm not suggesting it's not worth it. But this is a way to actually spend a very modest amount of money. I mean, in the millions, right? Not billions, not trillions. This is a you lose this spending in rounding.
Right.
This is a rounding error.
Sure.
But it's a way to address a need that a lot of military families have without breaking the bank and without having to necessarily, you know, because not everyone's, I mean, a pay raise, no one's going to refuse that. But I tell you, you can affect the margins. You can affect those families in need by doing something very modest but significant to them.
And have a larger impact. A bigger impact than a 50-cent pay raise. I mean, this gives them the ability to make some important choices.
Well, you're also not having to move. You're not having to increase the entire cost of your household to get closer to the education for your kids. And I was just looking in your article. I remembered you had given ages, and average age of military enlistees is 27, and for officers, age 34 and a half. Well,
that's
like we were talking about before, that's right when you get kids in school.
Yeah.
We've got to take another really quick break, and then we'll finish off the hour with our guest, Peter Murphy. He is with he's the Vice President for Policy at the Invest in Education Foundation. We've got all that linked up for you at wethepeopleradio.us. Folks like me and you, so let the voice of freedom sing out through this land. This is our country. From the East Coast to the West Coast, down the Dixie Highway, back home. This is our funny stuff. All righty. So what have we not touched upon? Did we leave anything out?
Well, I think that to the extent people can reach their members of Congress,
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, that's never a vain exercise. It's never a fruitless effort. Congress members respond to constituents, and I know it sounds a little quaint, but they really do.
Well, and you know, in you know, just by way of, you know, reminding people, there are, I don't even know how many, there are a zillion bills going on at any given time. And, you know, in the House anyway, you've got 435 people all working on different committees. So it's highly likely someone's member of Congress might not even know that this bill exists.
Well, we certainly spend our time trying to talk to everyone. And
right, but I mean, having people call and say, hey, where are you on this one? That's not a bad thing. I mean,
no, it's a great thing, and I appreciate the opportunity to tell your listeners that they should call their member of Congress. They should ask them to support H.R. 5199 and get this bill passed, get this done, do something for military, advance, you know, school choice, provide more opportunities for their families. I mean, this is a no-brainer. Like, are we going to – and just the fact that – and look, they don't need to know – you know, they don't need to know all 17 options they can use with the money.
Right, right.
In an education savings account. They can just simply say, support the military ESA bill, education savings account bill, and it's Jim – Congressman Banks from Indiana. Support that bill. Pass it.
And if they want to see what's in it, your best resource is Congress I just go to, actually, I linked it for you. Did I do the whole thing?
Right, congress.gov.
And type in H.R. Yep, 5199, and you can read the bill. You can look at the co-sponsors. You might want to do that before you call.
Yeah, I was curious. Is there bipartisan support for this? Or?
Not yet.
Not.
there really is, you know, you've got 70 plus members. I mean, it's a sad evolution that, you know, the Democratic Party, which was very pro-charter school 20 years ago. Bill Clinton was very pro-charter school as president. He made an enormous difference for good in expanding charter schools nationally with a federal role in doing so. That's really fallen away. I mean, the party today is not what it was a generation ago, and they've just taken a stance against school choice. I've seen it here in my home state of New York, where you had a lot of Democrats favor the scholarship tax credit approach in our state. And once the teachers union stepped in, I mean, that was the end of it. And, you know, in our state, we have a very strong religious school tradition in New York, serving immigrant families and Orthodox, Jewish, and Catholic. And so a lot of Democrats were very involved in that and helpful in that. But that, you know, the unions drew the line in the sand on this, and many of them have backed away from it. So it's, unfortunately, it's not been, as of late, a bipartisan effort. It's considered, you know, controversial.
That's
so
silly.
But people shouldn't accept that, you know, because again, I would stress, Aaron, that to be for school choice, to be for this bill for military families, to be for any school choice bill, is not a zero-sum game. This is not like, it's not like you're against public education just because you're for choice. You can be for both, and people are and should be for both, right? Support for one thing doesn't come at the expense of
right.
the other, or doesn't mean you're against it.
Well, heck, the kid could go to their, this is tutoring. There are all sorts of things that would enhance these students that would actually make them not only an asset to their community and give them a better future, but it would be an asset to the school that they attend. We have we also have Jacqueline on the line, and she has a question or comment for you.
Jacqueline,
go ahead.
Jacqueline,
you need to
turn your radio down just a wee bit, because we're going to be on a different time frame than your radio.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, hello. I've been calling all week for mostly the Democrats' office, trying to get them to accept school choice, because with all of these jobs we have baking right now, we do not have the students graduating who have the appropriate educational skills. And they're graduating from the inner city schools sometimes at a 50% graduation rate, which the people should know. And the Democrats want choice for abortion, but they do not want choice for schools, which is very, very strange. And a lot of these kids go to schools that are covered with graffiti. I'm a retired teacher. And you send the school to the child to the principal to get some discipline. He comes back sauntering in 2 minutes later with no discipline whatsoever. And you cannot teach lessons without discipline in your classroom. And that's what goes on in the inner city schools. So please, this sounds like a great bill. HR 5199 for the military, but we also need it for the general public. And actually, the private schools are cheaper than the public schools. A lot of the public schools are $12,000, $17,000 per student per year, where some of the private schools are only like $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 per year. And you get a much better education. There's no graffiti. The children are safe. The parents participate. They graduate sometimes at a 90% level, and they score well on all of our public education testing. So anyway, yes, definitely school choice should be the way it goes. And who is our guest speaker here? Peter who?
Peter Murphy.
Murphy. Okay, how do you get in touch with you, Peter?
You can check out our website, investineducation.org, investineducation.org. And Jacqueline, you may be a retired teacher technically, but you are still very much a teacher. We just learned a tremendous amount from your call. You're right on the money. I couldn't agree with you more. We have other legislation that we are pushing as well that would add, you know, that would provide a federal scholarship tax credit, that would provide incentives to invest in apprenticeships and skills training, just a very, you know, bring businesses more involved in investing in that, because, you know, you hit it right on the head that we're not, you know, we may be even the graduates that we're matriculating through are not necessarily college or career ready. There's a percentage
of
graduates
that really
aren't ready.
they're not able to read properly or write properly, and they do not know their math either.
Yeah.
So it's very strange that the Democrats want school choice, so they want choice for abortion, but they do not want choice for education. And I do not understand that, because it wouldn't hurt them at all. But, of course, the teachers' unions give all their money to the Democrats, and that's why it happens that way. But the teachers' unions are wrong, because they could easily get a job in a private school as well.
Yeah. Well, Jacqueline, thanks for the call, but you're a classic example of a teacher's voice is not necessarily the same voice as the teacher's union.
No,
so,
absolutely not. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you
for the
call.
Thanks, Jacqueline. Yeah, that is a good point. Sometimes, you know, everybody gets, lumped into...
Yeah, you get all sideways with the teachers, but they you know, they don't always agree with what's going on with the union, because the union, I think, takes a totally different look at the picture when the teachers are the ones in the classroom.
Well, very similar, like when I said that it's opposed by, you know, VFW, American Legion, AMVETS, those guys. That's not the guys in your local town. These are the, you know.
Yeah, this is front line.
This is the fancy hat guys back in D.C.
Teachers serve and help and educate students. Teacher unions work for adults.
Right.
I mean, the very interests are different.
And sometimes against
obviously
the
adults.
Obviously,
there's overlap in terms of compensation and bargaining for better wages and all that, which, you know, is necessary and important, okay? It's the rub that we have with teacher unions is the political activities and the political agenda. It's not bargaining for a better contract. It's not, you know, protecting against, you know, and ensuring due process and labor relations. I don't begrudge any teacher's interest and desire to have that, and the unions wanting to do those sorts of things. It's the political agenda is what we have a big problem with, and often, you know, that's what the fight's over.
Especially when
it's not unions per se. It's not traditional bargaining and and bettering them, you know, financially.
Well, it's when you start opposing good policy just because
it
doesn't suit your...
Exactly, that's where the fight is.
Yeah, that's silly. Well, I hope people will go take a look at this and, you know, pick up the phone, check with their member of the House and find out where they are in the support. Do you guys even know yet at this point if it has any support in the Senate, since that's where all good legislation goes to die?
Senator Ben Sasse and Senator Tim Scott, Ben Sasse from Nebraska, Tim Scott from South Carolina, they have a bill sponsored in the Senate side. But you know, the way the Senate is set up, it's a place where bills die. And so until the House kind of acts first and makes it a priority, you know, the Senate's just not going to look at it very, very strongly. I mean,
they don't put their neck in the news willingly.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, you know what? We very much enjoyed having you on. We always learn something new about what's going on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we always like it. We didn't talk about any tractors, but, you know, we had a lot of other things to discuss.
I'm still working.
Our guest has been Peter Murphy, the Vice President for Policy at the Invest in Education Foundation. You can find them at investineducation.org. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you very much.
I'm sure we'll chat with you later on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on with us.
Bye-bye.
All right, guys, and now we're headed into a little news break. It's probably the same news we've been hearing all day and for every day. So just roll with that for 5 minutes, and we'll be back with Dr. Harry Booyens, and we're going to talk about the politics in South Africa. I guarantee you it'll be interesting. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Afternoon. You're joining the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And?
I love staring at Bill and not saying anything.
Why do you do that?
I don't know.
Our sponsor this hour. Our sponsor this hour is Team Power, a John Deere and Kubota dealer here in Shasta Lake City, California. And you want a great deal on a tractor, go by and see them. They've got all sizes and shapes on sale right now. You can also get your service and parts there. You can reach them at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, in Shasta Lake City, or give them a call at 226-9226, or get them on the web at readingtractors.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
I especially like looking at Bill and waiting for him to do his commercial while he's chewing something.
That is just not true. Why do you make stuff
it's just,
up?
It's just, that's for, it's just free
right.
fun.
Oh. So unprofessional.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for the last 2 weeks, let's see, 2 weeks ago, May 27th, we did 1 hour on South Africa. And then last week, we did both hours on South Africa. And so this week, we're going to do another hour because every time we get into this topic, there's more. Obviously,
mm-hmm.
It's a huge topic that is not being covered, and I'm really, really heartened to see how many people are utilizing the archives on the website.
Yeah,
I know a lot.
Well,
of,
I'm hoping some other folks will pick it up and run with it too, because
yeah.
it really needs to be told.
Start pressing to have people in your area cover this issue so that people can get informed. Because yeah, I tell you, if you've been listening to the media in the U.S., you don't know anything about this. I know we sure didn't, and we. You know, I mean, we don't just watch one thing, I mean, or listen, or, you know, on the web. But there's quite a bit to this, and these folks are really being hung out to dry, and that's putting it kindly. So our guest is Dr. Harry Buyens. He's an internationally recognized multiple award-winning PhD in defense and aerospace. He is a physicist. It's like, what? So he comes from a science background, which is really great. This isn't all just a bunch of opinion and emotion. So he's originally from South Africa, and he has a 360-year bloodline in that country. He lives with his family currently on the forested slopes outside of Vancouver, Canada. But his life as a scientist exposed him to many of the realities of the Cold War and the period immediately following the fall of the Berlin Wall. It included interaction with the United States and the British defense establishment. So he has applied his lifetime of research and interpretive skills to history and genealogy. And I know he doesn't like this part, but it really is good, whoever wrote it. He writes with factual accuracy and an engaging style on these subjects. And, you know, we could listen to him tell us stories all day, even though this is tough information to hear. He makes it very palatable. I have information about his book and his blog, which is extremely informational, all on the website. You can find them all at wethepeopleradio.us. So, back to South Africa, and today we're talking about politics, because we kind of veered in and out of that. First show, I should just tell people, I guess, was history. Last week we talked about what's currently happening and kind of why. But I think it's important to go back and fill in the blanks on the actual politics that are happening in that country and what's driving all of this, I guess. So, that's the end of our part. Take it away.
Well, good morning, Aaron, Bill, and good morning to whoever is listening today. Yes, my name's Harry Buyens. That surname is an old German one from the far north of Germany, where there's still lots of those guys around. And it's an old German surname because my first ancestor of that surname arrived in South Africa in the year 1710, which is two generations later than my first ancestor down there, who arrived in 1657. And he wasn't even my oldest actual local ancestor, because I'm descended from the originals who lived in the Cape area. That's enough about my genealogy. That bit about being a physicist, Aaron, just really quickly. You know, I was born with a terrible affliction, and that's what made me become a physicist. So what you need to understand is that it is the desire for understanding stuff that drives people to become physicists. You don't become a physicist and then start trying to figure out how things work. It is the psychological conundrum of being unable to function unless you understand that makes people into physicists, and I suffer from that. That was, in my case, kind of exacerbated by the reality that my mother pointed out Sputnik to me when I was 2 months earlier than 4 years old. I was just on 4 years. And she pointed out Sputnik, and there and then she told me that the scientists put it up there, so I wanted to become a scientist as well. And that's how I ended up with a string of descriptions that you've just read. I would like to plead being a normal human being, and I would also like to explain that I don't have any gift of clairvoyance or anything like that. I'm just constantly irritated by the fact that why can't people figure these things out? I can really demonstrate that I'm not more intelligent than other people. I've had that tested. I know for a fact that my wife is much more intelligent than I am.
She reminds me of that every day.
No, I'm serious. She's kind of one of these prodigies that kept scoring 96 for all tests at university, and I had to really work hard to get to 75. So seriously, actually, I've learned to know when to shut up in the household, because as Bill will tell you, if there's 10 guys in a room and one lady walks in, the men are outnumbered. I assure you that the world is entirely flat. I know I'm a physicist, but the world's entirely flat and works the same way everywhere. And this little truth I just shared with you works the same way in South Africa.
Well, it does. And the sooner you accept that fact, the happier you'll be. So,
okay. With that as the intro, I mentioned to Aaron that I probably should just try and very quickly go through some of the points we've made in the previous sessions. One of those is that, and these are things that people generally don't know, and it confuses South Africans, because our jaws hit the ground when people speak to us, and we realize, oops, they don't know. The first thing is that white people have been in South Africa since 1652. That's when they got there, 1652. New York was 1625, so it's within a generation of New York. When they got there, the black people were 700 miles away as the crow flies, 800 along the coast. Next, black South African people were never enslaved by any white man from anywhere. That's an important point, and you'll see why in a little bit later. They were indeed enslaved by Mandela's Amakosa people. Or, as their chief Hintsa said to the British, "Are the Amafengu not my dogs? Can I not make with them as I please?" Ironically, these Amafengu people were freed from slavery by my ancestors. Hmm. Okay. And then in the weirdest ironic twist of all, it is actually the white folks in South Africa who have the slave ancestors, not the black people, really. And I'm a very good example of that, and I gave that description in an earlier session. The next major point was that there are remarkable parallels in history between South Africa and the United States. But unfortunately, there are sometimes parallels drawn that really are completely wrong and cause tremendous trouble. So let's look at just quickly some of the amazing parallels. Both were started by the Dutch before 1655. By the way, Cape Town and New York both had a street called Herengracht. In your case, that became Broadway, and in our case, in Cape Town, it stayed Herengracht.
Well, New York was previously known as New Amsterdam, wasn't
correct.
It? Correct. Yeah.
And just to push that point a little, my wife's one ancestor was the first American immigrant to the Cape in 1666, and she was in fact born in New York in what is today the shadow of the Goldman Sachs building. Now, the next thing, and always these amazing parallels, both were stolen by the English. I should call them English because they weren't the British back then, they were the English. They were both subsequently sold by the Dutch to the English. Both nations fought two wars against the British. Both won their first war. Okay? Amazingly, we, a little farming nation stuck in a little place in Africa, won the first war against the British. They were mad as anything about that. The big difference is South Africa lost the second one, and concentration camps were invented for my folks in there. I lost 57% of the Bruyens family members who went into those camps. 57% died there, mostly women and children.
And this was in 1901.
Okay.
Let's take, we have to take a really quick break, so I don't want to break up any of that, but yeah, let that sink in. Concentration camps in South Africa for the white people in 1901. So I think everybody credits Hitler with the invention of those, but no. Somebody beat him to it. The English. Going to take a quick break. We're here with our guest, Dr. Harry Bouyans. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone.
Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies. Tell me lies, tell me lies. Oh no, no, you can't disguise. You can't disguise. Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies.
I thought I'd throw that song in there as a little shout-out to the media. And what a great job they've done on South Africa.
I must remember that particular tune.
Very fitting.
I was like, why didn't I play that one before? That's a good one for Harry's show.
That was Fleetwood Mac, unless I'm mistaken.
Yep.
Was it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I should know. I've been playing in a band for many, many, many years. I first started playing guitar when I heard the Beatles the first time. So I'm in the category that's not allowed to make mistakes on the guitar anymore. I think I'll recognize Fleetwood Mac. That's the other thing about the science guys. They come in two categories, right? Those who want to play sport while they do their science and those who play music. I'm the mathematical type that plays music. Okay. I was going to say that last week we then went on to a category that I can best describe as sex, lies, and map-making. That related to the distribution of people, how those maps got made, what it had to do with demographics, hence my working the way the word sex in there. And the lies are always close to the surface when it comes to South Africa. The point to remember out of that little session, I guess, is that the western half of the country never really saw black people. The western half of the country. So most of this terrible trauma that you're hearing about is in the eastern half of the country. Now, Aaron, what you need to tell me is I now stand before a fork in the road. Of content. I have in my hand this little what if list that I see you put up on the website. I have the matter of the Black Economic Empowerment Act in South Africa, which should be called the White Economic Destruction Act.
Yeah, we've got to do that.
And then there is the sort of brazen political history there. Okay? I'm inclined to go with the central point, which is this Black Economic Empowerment Act thing.
Yes,
well, I'd like to start, if we could, could we go back to when they got rid of apartheid, the Mandela movement, so to speak. Everybody was, you know, oh my gosh, he's been freed, you know, South Africa now is going to be, you know, a new country. That's not really the truth. I mean,
well, that's where this Black Empowerment Act comes in.
Yeah, let's go there and let people know what really happened during that time.
Okay, I think history since 1994, and I'm sort of thinking on the fly here about it, can probably be divided into a number of periods. The first period is Nelson Mandela is in charge. He's making every day conciliatory comments. There's that big international rugby match that everybody's seen movies about. You know, half of that, of course, is junk, but the principle is still there. The overwhelming emotion of the day when this guy who had tried to kill us walks up and everybody's cheering for the same side. I mean, that's very powerful. There's no doubt about it. So that was the first era. But he didn't really manage or do anything. He had guys under him doing stuff. You know, it's best summarized by a lady at the place where I worked, a manager on the same level as me, sitting in a meeting and somebody making a statement out front saying, Mandela this, Mandela that, Mandela this, Mandela that. And she pumps me in my side. So this is a black lady manager. She pumps me in my side and she says, what the hell does Mandela know? He sat in jail for 26 years. Now, that's not me saying it. That is my colleague, a black lady, pumping me in the side, whispering that in my ear.
Now, this is during a time of great transition from white to black control.
Sure. The government is a fully black control at that point already. At the point that I'm talking about, the old National Party had essentially gone defunct. And it's just as this Thabo Mbeki character, the next guy, was taking over. Mbeki was the vice president essentially to, or one of the vice presidents to Mandela. The other guy, the one that Mandela really wanted to follow him up, was Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, Ramaphosa, I'm going to roll that R because in his nation they do it too. So Cyril Ramaphosa, he is of the Venda nation in the far, far distant northern little smidgen of South Africa. He was born in Soweto, but his culture, background, and some of his education was in the far north. Ramaphosa was the guy who really negotiated the whole transfer from the old white government to Mandela. So Ramaphosa is a very competent guy. Make no mistake about that. Ramaphosa knows what he's doing. He's a competent politician. He's a competent negotiator. He is no one's idiot. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work, and Thabo Mbeki became the next president. Mbeki was president until about 2007. Now, over that period, this act, this Black Economic Empowerment Act, was imposed. I'm telling you that as a guy who lived in South Africa in the period when Mbeki took over, it was like ice water was poured over the country. And immediately, if you were a white man, you knew that you're in trouble. You knew you were in trouble. It's just the way that Mbeki handled everything. It was vividly obvious that he hated white men.
Were there any whites at this point in any capacity in the government?
Oh, yeah. But those who had any kind of authority were communists.
Okay.
Okay. So, and I personally met some of them. I shook hands with some of them. And if you read my book, you'll find the one guy in there. Okay? And he was one of those that had hidden out in a bomb shelter in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, while the South African Air Force bombed them. This in retaliation for the biggest car bomb that South Africa ever suffered. So, yeah, he was a foot soldier on the other side, and so he happens to be a white guy. Big deal. I'm not going to be swayed by the fact that his skin is white.
Mm-hmm.
So that second period was Mbeki, and he started implementing, based on Ramaphosa's plans, he started implementing these laws that started to grind down white people, systematically grind them down in every way conceivable. And then in 2007, it turned to open political warfare between the biggest or the highest ranking Zulu guy in that ANC party, and his name was Jacob Zuma. And Zuma won the toss, so to speak. Now, what you need to understand is that ANC party has such a preponderance of votes in, or has always had, such a preponderance of votes in parliament that your national president is not determined by the general democratic voter. It's determined by the party caucus. Because whoever becomes the leader of the party automatically defaults to being the president of the country. So you've got to get your heads off the idea that South Africans vote for a president like you voted for Donald Trump. It just doesn't happen. That's not the way it works. Okay? So we just get the guy because their party said so. Period. Whoever they decide, that's what you got to live with. So that's the system that they have. So first it was Mandela, and it was called, people refer to it as the honeymoon. Then there was Mbeki, which was like a ton of iced water going down your back. And it's over that period that I and my family packed our bags and left. And then 2007 onwards came Zuma. And Zuma, I'm frankly going to describe him as intelligent, but culturally very much the standard Zulu tribal chief. Corrupt as anything. You pay your homage to the chief. You bring him presents, and he gives you presents. He doles out where you can put your hut, etc., etc.
Now, was he communist?
He's a communist, absolutely.
Okay.
I'll have to come back to this thing of land ownership, because in Africa, the idea of individual land ownership is not comprehended. Okay, their idea of African socialism is not communism as in the Russian model. So we need to come back to that somehow. But for now, because you asked me to explain the politics, first Mandela, then Mbeki, then came the Zuma character, and it was obvious almost from day one that this is going to be a classic corrupt African village. That's what we had. And today I started receiving links from concerned South Africans here in Canada. They've dug out just how the tax coffers have been raided in South Africa, for example. The man stole the country blind. Okay? And he imported guys from India, a family of brothers, who basically started running the country, and they were deciding on who was going to be appointments to cabinet posts and stuff like that. And they only appointed guys that would, you know, give them kickbacks and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute, just endless corruption. Millions of dollars just disappeared down a hole. So,
what a great transition. That's just what every country needs. Oh my gosh. We have to take a really quick break and then we'll delve back into the corruption.
This is what I need to know.
Get back to the false stage.
Yeah, we can't cut out before the corruption. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Harry Booyans. That's what we're hoping for. Although we won't be discussing the hero in this segment.
Okay.
All right, Harry.
Hear it?
Yep.
Okay, if we can move on. That noise in the background is me quickly printing out some of the paperwork related to that act that we want to get to.
Okay.
I've mentioned that there were four phases in this political history since 94. The first was, call it the honeymoon with Mandela. The second was the ice water down the back with Thabo Mbeki. The third one was true black African village style corruption setting in for the years from until now. And then roughly a year before he was due to stand for another election or be kicked out, Zuma was dethroned by Ramaphosa, Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, just to run through it, the first president was basically of the broader Amakosa nation. This Mandela. Mbeki, similarly, was one of those. The third one was a Zulu. And now the fourth one, he's of the Bavenda. He is of the Venda nation. The Ba prefix is another way of saying nation. So Cyril Ramaphosa, he was Mandela's favorite understudy.
So he was ANC?
Say again?
What was he? Was he part of the ANC?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. Everybody that I've mentioned, all of them are totally that party. And Ramaphosa basically went up against the Zuma faction in the party right at the end of last year and the earlier part of this year. And somewhere around February, he finally got the job. But apparently only after a midnightly deal in which he committed to this idea of land expropriation without compensation. So to get the votes inside the party caucus, he did that. And sure enough, when that matter came before Parliament, the ANC voted for it. And that now requires a change in the constitution, which requires a certain percentage vote. And it is likely that they will get that vote in Parliament if they go for it. But it's so-called Article 25 of the Constitution would have to be changed to allow for expropriation without remuneration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like I said last time, you guys have got eminent domain, but I believe it pretty clearly says that there has to be remuneration. And I believe I even heard President Trump defend that on one occasion. And I can understand that. But this is something else. This is legalized theft we're talking about. And this is nationalization by any other word. It means taking people's due titled property. And it doesn't just say land. It says property. Folks need to understand that. So they're wanting to take that land. Now,
and it isn't like they're trying to build a road, like here, you know, typically, I mean, okay, tons of abuses on eminent domain, I'm not defending it, but the idea originally was they were going to build a road and your house was in the way, and so for the betterment of everybody, you had to, you know, move.
Yes.
This is different.
Yeah.
This is basically, you're the wrong color, and so we're coming to take your stuff.
Bluntly put, yes. And in case you think it's an exaggeration, please be advised that one of the senior guys in the Communist Party was asked to put together a committee to look into how this might work. And he came back and he said, well, that vote in Parliament was maybe not too cleverly conceived because it might backfire in that they might end up taking black people's property. By implication, that means the intention was to take white people's property. Let's make no mistake about that. Okay. So, I mean,
yeah, they're not very good at being politicians.
So that's where folks now are. Now, the reason why the BEE, Black Economic Empowerment legislation, is relevant now is, suppose these farmers have their lands taken. First of all, they got almost zero chance of getting any form of employment because they were white. And the affirmative action process in that country makes it virtually impossible for a white man over 40 to get a job. Now, the next thing they can do is set up a business, right? I mean, we're good. Westerners, we can be entrepreneurial. We can set up business. There's 40-odd million black people who would want to buy stuff, etc., right? That makes cool sense. No problem. Right. Okay, let's go for it. Uh-oh. Here's a problem. There is Cyril Ramaphosa's Act, the Black Economic Empowerment Act, made, you know, basically fathered by, sponsored by, driven by, thought up by none other than the current state president. And according to that act, if you have a business that makes that has a revenue of more than $1 million, now that's not a big number by any American standard, I would submit, and that's revenue, not profit. If you have a revenue greater than that, then you are subject to the Black Economic Empowerment Act. And the first thing it does is it says that you need to, suppose you don't make the grade according to that act. You can carry on working, but if you do make the grade, which means you score the right brownie points, and I'll explain these brownie points in a moment. Only if you score those brownie points will bigger companies buy from you, or will you get state tenders. Now I have to come at this problem from another side, and it's something that Americans in particular struggle with. You struggle with the following concept because you are 330 million people and you cannot conceive of a nation where getting enough cash together in one heap to do stuff is difficult. One of the most fantastic things about the United States is that the cost of capital is low. In my life as a high-tech guy, I went to the U.S. to try and get money to do projects. And it's tremendously difficult because they kept saying, why don't you just go and raise the capital and build the thing first and then come and show it to us? And my response is, well, where would I go for that? The U.S. is the only place that really has this low cost of capital. Everywhere else, you're half dead by the time you've got the cash together. You haven't got enough life left to actually do the thing. So smaller countries rely very heavily on state tenders and state contracts because that's where the capital concentrates. And there are no IBMs and huge big Boeings and things like that in the other countries that can gather enough capital together to sponsor big projects. So it's a big deal. Now, in South Africa, when a company that does not conform to that act tries to get a contract to survive, he's now limited to buying and selling basically to other guys like himself. So you are stuck with the minnows and the small fry.
Right.
Okay, now you can imagine what that means. So what they've done is they've incentivized this thing in the most vicious way you can conceive of. They have made a law that says if your company is over $1 million, then here's how it works. You need to conform in order to get these big contracts that big companies survive on. You have to have 100 BEE brownie points, and those brownie points contain things like, is your company majority black owned? Is it majority black managed? Does it have a majority of black employees? Do you spend enough money on good stuff for black people out there, and always the word black? And in case you have difficulty understanding the word black, they actually explain it at the top of the act, where they say in as just about as many words, black is anybody who's not white.
Or any kind of a mix that they call colored in South Africa, correct?
Well,
do they still get short shrift?
That's become a bit of a gray area, but basically, if you're white, you're done.
Okay.
Okay. And in case there was confusion for the Chinese folks, they actually went to court and told the government, well, you know, these terrible acts you have against the white people, they're really hurting us. And so they were made honorary blacks.
Really?
Yeah. So,
That makes perfect sense.
I was in a band with two Chinese siblings here in Vancouver. I used to play in a band with Chinese folks in South Africa. So I upped my roots, moved to Canada, and played in a band with two Chinese South Africans over here again. And I joked with them. I said, I'm glad to hear you guys are now honorary black.
That's a pretty good deal if you can get it.
Yeah, so if you are unclear, the Act actually just explains for you that black means anyone who is not white. So that would cover, I guess, Mongolians and Eskimos. I don't know who, okay? It's just, it's crazy. It's so brazen. These things that are done are so brazenly anti-white, specifically anti-white. Okay? Now, I don't know how far you are from a commercial break.
We're kind of right there.
I want to read you just a little bit. This comes from The Economist, July the 8th, 2017. Okay? I want to read you just one little paragraph. Mining firms are also being hurt by government policies. A new mining charter, this is the Black Economic Empowerment Charter, introduced last month by South Africa's minister, Mosambenzi Zwane, would force companies to ensure... to ensure that at least 30% of their shares are in black hands, up from 26 previously. Under the new charter, companies would be required to maintain this level of black ownership regardless of whether black investors sell out. Think about that bit. Think about that. Think about what that means. They get 20% of their investors to be black. And then some of them say, oh, cool, I've just been given money. Let me, and investor in South Africa, if it's a black investor, it usually means the white guy just gave up and gave him the shares for free, okay? Or fiddled it around the side so that he seems to have the money. They would also have to pay out at least 1% of their turnover, what you guys would call revenue, each year to their black shareholders. So, had this rule been in effect in 2016, black shareholders would have got 5.8 billion South African rands of the total of 5.9 billion rand paid as dividends, leaving pretty much nothing for anyone else, notes the Chamber of Mines of South Africa. How would you like to have an investment where you get a dividend no matter what the hell happens?
Yeah.
Wow.
And all you have to do is be black. That's all you have to do.
So how are they, well, when we come back, I'm curious, how are they able to bring any investors in if these rules are in effect? So we'll talk about that when we come back.
And therein lies the problem and the ultimate destruction going forward. Things like this only work for a little while. It's like a weird Ponzi scheme, you know. They eventually, well, what is it? They run out of other people's money.
Yeah.
Maggie Thatcher was perfectly right. And this is why Cyril Ramaphosa is here in Canada this weekend.
Oh.
Looking for money.
Lovely.
All right.
All right. Quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Dr. Harry Bouyans. You can find all the information about him and previous shows with him in the last couple of weeks, so you don't feel like you came in halfway through the movie, at wethepeopleradio.us.
What I felt was right. Like a rock, like a rock. I was strong as I could be, like a rock. Nothing ever got to me, like a rock. I was something to see, like a rock.
You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody else. Pressure. You've only had to run so far, so good. But you will come to a place where the only thing you feel are loaded guns in your face. You'll have to deal with pressure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that pretty much sizes it up.
That's the new theme song of the Black Economic Empowerment Act.
So, you know, I was thinking, I have here in front of me an article that was written in the last several days by a guy named Gerard Papenfuss. He's the chief executive of the National Employers Association, not employee, but employer association of South Africa. So he's written an open letter to the labor minister. And he says, if you'll allow me to read, because I cannot state it any better than this guy does. Dear Minister, since I am, quote, white, comma, I take note that when you talk so boldly about us, quote, whites, being the stumbling block in terms of your transformation agenda, I write this letter to you in order to get clarity. According to your party's National Democratic Revolution, they love this word revolution because they're communists, the eventual target of your, quote, transformation, unquote, policies is that every facet of the South African society, that is, people in employment, ownership of business, participation in sports teams, shares on the Joburg Stock Exchange, education, the list goes on and on, comma, must reflect the demographical composition of South African society, approximately 80% black, 10% white, 8% colored, and 2% Indian. Hard work and skills are no longer the criteria, just the color of your skin. Quality is sacrificed in an obsessive pursuit of quotas on the basis of skin color. Total madness, exclamation mark. However, you, Minister, and your colleagues are pursuing these ideals bit by bit in every area and in every piece of legislation. Minister, since the NDR envisages a seamless transition, you have to pursue this destructive path, and the current status and intensity of all transformational legislation is therefore merely an interim arrangement in your attempt to achieve your ideological version of a transformed society. The term seamless transition implies you'll never achieve it. Even Hitler could not. But you will not stop trying, turning on the screws as you're flailing while systematically breaking down the economy. And then he says, you are obviously frustrated by the lack of progress measured against your ideas and the ideals of your revolution. Therefore, Minister, you need to give us employers some clarity as to how you want us to implement your plan, seeing as you have given us 6 months to rectify the so-called, quote, situation, failing which, according to you, we will, quote, face the full might of the law. Since the, quote, whites, unquote, in our employ has such a, quote, tight grip, unquote, on their jobs, according to you, please advise, Minister, how we can get rid of them, should any employer wish to do so. Their rights are entrenched in the Constitutional Republic and Labor Relations Act. This is the kind of thing, by the way, this is Harry now. Everybody gets all pink and happy about the South African Constitution, all this stuff, and people like saying it's a wonderful constitution, but they don't deal with the realities. This act is the actual reality. Since you are, Mr. Minister, a custodian of this act, you must be aware of the fact that huge penalties await employers if they dismiss employees without good reason, and the penalty is even more severe if the dismissal is done for reasons based on color of anyone's skin. So, even if we want to get rid of these, quote, whites, unquote, it is not possible within the current legal framework. These pieces of legislation which protects minorities against unfair dismissal must be a source of huge frustration to you, Minister, especially against the backdrops of your desire to rid the workplace of these, quote, whites, unquote, who so, quote, stubbornly, unquote, cling to their jobs. Are you getting the general drift of this?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because here they're clinging to what, Bibles and guns, and there they're trying to cling to their jobs. We're just in different phases
in
of this
lives.
Program.
And here comes the bit where he spells it out. Should the employers decide to rid the workplaces of these stubborn whites, unquote, even unlawfully, they are faced with a moral dilemma, Minister. Where will they go? If your transformation plan is to be implemented to the letter, there would be no place for them to go. The state, the parastatal organizations, the municipalities, even the corporate private sector are no-go areas for them as long as the seamless transition of yours applies. And if you could have your wish, since the demographic targets will never be met, they will have nowhere to go forever.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the sad part is they will be forever dependent on foreign aid
As a country.
As a country.
But you know what? If you go to Wikipedia, because, you know, it's always a great resource. Kidding. It was interesting because here's a little quote from the Black Economic Empowerment Commission. There's just the first sentence is a killer. It's an integrated and coherent socioeconomic process. It's located within it. Within the context of the country's national transformation program.
Yeah.
Guys, if you've ever read anything
crazy
written by the old-style communists, you'll notice this one thing they suffer from. They have a terrible inferiority complex, and they try to conjure up fancy words and statements and five-year plans. Anything that they think will sound clever to the so-called, unquote, masses that they and their cadres that they lead, you know. So it's important to these people to always sound like they have a fancy theory. It's like, you know, I've dealt with many scientists in my life, and as soon as they speak fancy, I know they don't know their subject.
Yeah,
kind of funny how that works.
Fancy.
That's true in a lot of different things.
Yeah. They can cut the fancy speak and get to the facts. This guy, Papenfuss, is getting to the facts. The communists like fancy speak and don't like being called on the numbers.
I can imagine.
That's why I said liberals and communists cannot do maths. You cannot make 90% of the country rich by forever stealing from 10% of the population. You cannot make 40 million black people rich by stealing farms from 35,000 farmers. All you're going to get is ineffectual little blotches of land, none of which will be effective, none of which will be economic. It is death.
Yeah, and none of them will grow food. Kind of short-sighted in so many ways, it's hard to even point out. So, of course, we only have 2 minutes left because we never have enough time on this. You had made a comment in a phone call that we had about tearing down the... I mean, this seems like a real swerve here, but I just wanted to make sure we included it. The tearing down of the Confederate statues.
Yeah. Born in South Africa. I cannot remember now exactly which date it was, but during early last year or late the year before, there was a whole effort that started at Cape Town University around the matter of the statue of Cecil John Rhodes. Now, I hate that guy because he caused the deaths of many of my family and made a war on us. But I don't want his statue torn down. That seems just stupid. Anyway... So they these black students gathered and they threw feces all over the statue, demanded it be torn down, and eventually the lame rear-ended Cape Town University chiefs tore the statue down, moved it away, and so be it. Next thing, a black South African student ended up at Oxford University, and at Oxford University the next moment they heard the same thing, and suddenly statues had to be torn down at Oxford. And then students at Berkeley acknowledged the Oxford effort and started talking about it, and the next moment it was Robert E. Lee's turn.
Isn't that stunning? I just wanted to make sure we didn't miss that link, since that's a huge factor. All right, Harry, we're out of time, but we're doing this some more because we can't get enough South Africa. What's actually going on? Obviously, we're not being told any of this. Thank you so much for wising us up. And to all our new friends in South Africa, hang in there, you guys. We're paying attention. See you guys next week. You can find all the information at WeThePeopleRadio.us.